From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
President Ariel Sharon has embraced the roadmap to peace from President Bush. In so doing, he has reassured his own constituency that he will never give up the majority of the West Bank. That demonstrates very clearly how empty the roadmap to peace really is.
As the Israeli government decides whether to allow official spokespeople to use the word occupation, we'll have a conversation about the so-called roadmap to peace with Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun magazine and the president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, Ziad Asli. Also, investigative reporter Greg Palace on internal U.S. government documents on which corporations get contracts to rebuild Iraq and Africa's First World War. We'll hear how Western nations and corporations like Barrick Gold are implicated in the brutal war in the Congo. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon has announced plans to send in 20,000 more U.S. troops to Iraq to help bring law and order to the country. The London Independent reports this will bring the total U.S. forces to 163,000. Earlier today, two U.S. soldiers were killed, nine others wounded in Fallujah, where they were attacked by rocket-propelled grenades. This comes a day after what the Los Angeles Times called one of the most violent days against the U.S. presence since the end of the invasion. On Monday, attackers fired rocket-propelled grenades, heavy machine guns, and small arms at a U.S. convoy, killing one soldier and injuring another in an attack northwest of Baghdad in the town of Haditha. Hours later, a U.S. military vehicle ran over a landmine on the outskirts of Baghdad. One soldier died and three more were injured in the incident, which CENTCOM said appeared to be the result of hostile action. Near the site of the attack, one man told the Los Angeles Times, "This is only the beginning. These people declared holy war against the American people." A U.S. military outpost in a town north of Baghdad was also hit in a grenade attack. No injuries were reported. And in the town of Baiji, near Tikrit, a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division. The device failed to explode. The Washington Post reports an average of one U.S. soldier has died every day since President Bush declared on May 1st that, quote, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. The average daily death toll was three during the major combat operation. The Washington Post yesterday detailed the story of Marlon Rockhold. The 23-year-old from Hamilton, Ohio, was shot dead by a sniper in Baghdad on May 8th. On that same day, his grandmother received a letter from him dated 2 weeks earlier. It read in part, "I'm doing just fine now that the war is over here in Iraq. To actually take a man's life is more than I ever cared to do," he wrote. "But it was either them or me. I don't know what they were told, but God told me I was coming home." The UN's most senior humanitarian official in Iraq, Ramiro Lopez da Silva, warned yesterday that U.S. attempts to rebuild the country are overly dominated by ideology and risk triggering a violent backlash. According to The Guardian of London, da Silva said the sudden decision last week to demobilize 400,000 Iraqi soldiers without any redeployment program could generate a low-intensity conflict in the countryside. Meanwhile, Agence France-Presse reports a band of Iraqi army officers took to the streets of Baghdad yesterday to protest their plight since the dissolution of the army by the U.S.-led administration in Iraq. They warned of further protests and even suicide bombings if their situation is not reconciled. Under pressure from the United States, the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, admitted the Palestinian people are being held under occupation and that the occupation must end. In a frank speech before an assembly of Likud lawmakers, Sharon said, "It is not possible to continue holding 3.5 million people under occupation. You may not like the word, but what's happening is occupation. This is a terrible thing for Israel, for the Palestinians, and for the Israeli economy." Unquote. Sharon's comments came one day after his cabinet backsteps in Washington's roadmap to peace. In response to the vote, a leader of the Israeli settler movement described it as a, quote, act of national treason. There are now 226,000 Jewish settlers living in the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, The Guardian reports Likud lawmakers berated Sharon for abandoning party ideals. Already, Sharon seems to be backtracking on key measures in the peace plan, including the halt of new Israeli settlements and the abandonment of some of the occupied territories. A settler and Likud lawmaker asked Sharon yesterday, "I want to know whether I can stay in my home." Sharon replied, "It will definitely be possible, and there is no restriction here. You can build for your children and grandchildren, and I hope even for your great-grandchildren." The Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers, Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas, plan to meet in Jerusalem soon to pave the way for an expected peace summit with President George Bush next month. The United Nations agency UNICEF is warning of a looming humanitarian crisis in Aceh, where the Indonesian military has launched its largest invasion in quarter of a century. The London Independent reports the Indonesian government has been slow to address humanitarian needs. Local officials say a massive relief operation is required, particularly in the countryside. Indonesia is also forcing relief agencies to channel humanitarian aid through the government. The Iranian opposition group, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, said yesterday it has evidence of two previously undisclosed uranium enrichment facilities west of Tehran. This comes as the Bush administration is trying to build international support for the International Atomic Energy Agency to look further into Iran's nuclear program. The Australian Mail on Sunday reports the U.S. has floated plans to turn Guantanamo Bay into a death camp with its own death row and execution chamber. Prisoners would be tried, convicted, and executed without leaving its boundaries, without a jury, and without a right of appeal. Saying black people are in danger of being left behind at the newest frontier of medical research, Howard University plans to create the nation's largest repository of DNA from African Americans, this according to the New York Times. The samples would be used to find genes involved in diseases with particularly high rates among blacks, like hypertension and diabetes. Howard plans to gather blood samples or cheek swabs from 25,000 people over 5 years, mainly patients at hospitals associated with the Howard College of Medicine. And this from today's Newsday, the family of a West African merchant fatally shot by police last week at a Chelsea storage facility was preparing yesterday for burial in his remote village, while his uncle in New York joined the Reverend Al Sharpton in calling for a special prosecutor to investigate the death. Sharpton is quoted as saying, "Because of the glaring possibility of conflicts of interest, the Manhattan District Attorney cannot independently and fairly or objectively investigate a case that may involve its own office." Sharpton also called for a special prosecutor to investigate the death of Alberta Spruill, who died of a heart attack after a botched raid on her Harlem apartment May 16th. Police detonated a flash grenade in her apartment and handcuffed her before they said they realized they had the wrong apartment. Sharpton said he's also looking into bringing members of Zongo's family to the United States, tapping on experience in the Amadou Diallo shooting to navigate through the bureaucratic mazes.
You and I once were a gambler. Boy, but I lost my money soon. Yes, I once was a gambler. Boy, but I lost my money soon. Yeah, you know I lost all of my money, some of them. Some of the gambler can have my room. In a no good gambling game. Yes, I lost all my money. Boys, in a no good gambling game.
Lightning Hopkins, The Gambler's Blues, here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Army Radio is reporting that the Foreign Ministry is weighing distributing an internal regulation that will allow Israel's official spokespeople to use the word occupation for the first time. The step follows unprecedented remarks by Israel's Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon. Yesterday, he told lawmakers, "I think the idea that it is possible to continue keeping 3.5 million Palestinians under occupation, yes, it is occupation, you might not like the word, but what is happening is occupation, is bad for Israel and bad for the Palestinians and bad for the Israeli economy. Controlling 3.5 million Palestinians cannot go on forever. You want to remain in Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, and Bethlehem?" he asked. According to Israeli Army Radio, until now, the word occupation was considered forbidden because it was believed Israel would be seen in a bad light. All of this comes as Sharon appears to be giving some support to Washington's so-called roadmap to peace. Yesterday, Israeli officials said President Bush will attend a three-way summit with Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas in Jordan next week. On Sunday, Sharon convinced his cabinet to give conditional approval to the U.S. peace plan. It's the first time in history the Israeli government has formally accepted the idea of a Palestinian state. But Sharon is still sending mixed signals. He also said yesterday the government will continue to expand Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. He told a Likud lawmaker and settler he can stay in his home. He said there's no restriction here. You can build for your children and grandchildren, and I hope even for your great-grandchildren. Meanwhile, the expected meeting tomorrow between Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his Palestinian counterpart Mahmoud Abbas has been postponed for a day. Palestinian sources told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz the delay was caused by scheduling conflicts. But the Guardian of London reports the cancellation is being interpreted as evidence that the Palestinian leader doesn't see any value in meeting Sharon, and that the Palestinians believe all of Sharon's latest moves are purely for propaganda purposes. We're joined right now in the studio by Rabbi Michael Lerner, founder of Tikkun magazine, and author of a number of books, including Jewish Renewal, A Path to Healing and Transformation, and Jews and Blacks, A Dialogue on Race, Religion, and Culture in America, which he co-wrote with Cornel West. We're joined on the telephone by Ziad Asali, president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Asli was born in Jerusalem and studied at the American University of Beirut. He practiced medicine in Saudi Arabia, Jerusalem, and the United States, and is also current chair of the American Committee on Jerusalem. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Hi.
Thank you.
Well, it's very good to have you both with us. Let's first get response to the latest move. Yesterday, Israel formally endorsing an internationally brokered plan for peace in the Middle East, joining with Palestinians and accepting the framework. Israeli officials said Bush will attend this three-way summit next week in Jordan. Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Well, I definitely think it's a good thing that Ariel Sharon has called this an occupation. But I don't think we can believe that we're moving towards an end of the occupation. Sharon is preparing the Israeli public for the concessions he's willing to make. And those concessions are to give back to the Palestinian people less than 50% of the West Bank and Gaza in his plan for a Palestinian state, a Palestinian state that essentially would be non-viable. It would occupy less than 11% of pre-48 Palestine, and it would be unacceptable to the Palestinian people. And I think that is not really going to end up being something that will end the struggle between Israel and the Palestinians. What Palestinians rightly ask for is a return of Israel to the pre-67 borders with minor border modifications to allow a few of the border settlements to be incorporated into Israel and to allow the wall and some Jewish sections of Jerusalem to be part of the Jewish state. But that's not what Sharon has in mind, and that's why there's really no contradiction in what he said yesterday. You see, what he's saying is that on the one hand, he's willing to allow for a Palestinian state, but on the other hand, it's going to be a sliver of the West Bank and Gaza, and that none of the settlements will have to be removed. So it turns out that the roadmap to peace is actually not going to lead to peace. It's going to lead to a process. At the end of 3 years, there will then be a negotiation. And at the end of those negotiations, the Palestinians will be granted something that they haven't been asking for, namely a tiny sliver of the West Bank.
Hmm. In the Wall Street Journal today, Peace quotes an Israeli official who said privately, "What chance are we taking?" asking why not support the roadmap to peace. He said, the person quoted said, "Abu Mazen's going to fail anyway. At least then we can say we did everything we could." Sharon's political opponents are equally cynical about his motives. Quote, "Sharon was just trying to get the Americans off his back," said Yossi Sarid, a lawmaker from the left-wing opposition Meretz Party and former minister. He's hoping the Palestinians will not be able to live up to their commitments.
They couldn't possibly, you see, because what the roadmap offers is almost nothing to the Palestinian moderates. What the moderates need to be able to say to the extremists is, if you stop your acts of violence and go through this process at the end of 3 years, you will have a significant and real state. But what actually is being offered to them is that at the end of the 3 years, there will be a negotiation. And at that negotiation will then determine the nature of that state. That's why we're calling for what the Tikkun community is creating a teach-in next week in Washington, D.C., and we're introducing to Congress a plan that articulates what the end of the process will be. Because if you present to people what the end of the process is, and it's something that's actually something that meets the needs of the Palestinian people, then that empowers the moderates to be able to say to the extremists, look, if you stop, we're going to get something real. But at this, but in this way, the way that the roadmap is currently constructed, what should be the first step is the last step, and the last step is a negotiation that could very well lead to what Ariel Sharon wants, which is a non-state or a state that is a state only in name. So that's why Dennis Kucinich next week, at the time of our teach-in in Washington, is going to introduce a resolution for Middle East peace that articulates in the way that Tikkun has called for the details of what a last step in this settlement process could be that would end the occupation and at the same time provide security for Israel.
Ziad Asaleh, your response to the so-called roadmap to peace.
Only a hopeless optimist would think that something momentous has happened, but nevertheless, something significant has happened in Mr. Sharon admitting the obvious, which is that there is an occupation, that we have to deal with it, and that it cannot be sustained. So far, this has been outside of the lexicon of governments in Israel. That's good. The second is that there are actually three parties to this equation. One is the Palestinians, the other is the Israelis, and the third is the Americans. The roadmap is essentially an American plan with the blessing of other powerful entities. And it does mean that there is an interest for the United States in seeing some kind of a resolution to this long festering problem that has undoubtedly contributed to world terrorism and the mess that we're in now. So there is an interest for the United States to resolving this problem. The question is how serious and how committed is this administration in resolving it? How seriously is it viewing its own roadmap? The indications that we hear is that there is a level of commitment, a personal commitment from the president and his administration to do that. There is something in the roadmap for everyone, and there is not enough for any of the players. So it is, you hear different remarks and objections and reservations, and they're all reasonable and make sense. However, it is entirely possible, if it is applied properly with political forces aligned behind it, to end up with a two-state solution, generally on the 1967 border modified, mutually agreed borders defined, the shared Jerusalem. And the significant part of it is what it offers to the Arabs also. Peace for Israel with all the Arab governments, because that is included in the incorporation of the Saudi plan adopted by the Arab League. So it is possible to get the results that we all call for without having necessarily to accept Mr. Sharon's 42% definition of the Palestinian state. How the policy shapes up will depend on the political forces behind each and every party.
Why we're bringing people to try to create a progressive middle path that's an alternative to AIPAC, because the AIPAC forces in the United States, that's the pro-Ariel Sharon lobby, have incredible power in the Congress. And part of the reason they have that power is because the rest of us have not organized in any serious way. And that's part of why we're doing this teach-in next week in Washington, asking people from every congressional district in the United States to please come to Washington to participate with us in an effort to make clear to the Congress that there is another voice in this country besides the right-wing voice of the AIPAC lobby, the pro-Ariel Sharon lobby, and that there is a significant section of Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, secular humanists, everyone in this country who really do want an alternative to the Ariel Sharon path and want a peace-oriented policy that actually allows the Palestinians a real state and not just a sliver of a state.
Rabbi Michael Lerner and Ziad Asli, president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, will come back. And I want to ask Ziad Asli about the role of Elliot Abrams in all of this, the notorious Iran-Contra figure now at the center of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Stay with us. Dalida here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Looking at the front page of the Washington Post today, back in political forefront, Iran-Contra figure plays key role on Mideast with a photograph of Elliot Abrams. It says a cycle of disgrace and redemption has brought one of Washington's most accomplished and controversial bureaucratic infighters back to the center of U.S. foreign policy decision-making. When Elliot Abrams stood in front of a federal judge in October 91 and pleaded guilty to two misdemeanor counts of withholding information from Congress, few imagined he would ever return to government. At age 43, he'd become one of the casualties of the Iran-Contra scandal, detested by Democrats for his combative political style, and mistrusted by human rights activists for playing down the crimes of right-wing dictatorships in Central America. 12 years later, Abrams is helping to shape White House policies toward many of the world's trouble spots. Appointed in December as President Bush's senior advisor on the Middle East, his responsibilities extend from Algeria to Iran, but nowhere is his influence more evident than on the Arab-Israeli peace process. A self-described neoconservative and neo-Reaganite with strong ties to Jews and evangelical Christians, Abrams has become a flashpoint for the debate on how much pressure the Bush administration is prepared to apply to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to reach an agreement with the Palestinians. Last week, the White House sought to address Israeli concerns about a U.S.-endorsed roadmap on Israeli-Palestinian peace by saying they would be considered during the implementation phase. And the Washington Post goes on to say the question for many critics, both inside and outside the government, is whether the White House will risk a public fight with Sharon on freezing and eventually reversing Jewish settlement activity that could antagonize some of its core political supporters in the run-up to a presidential election. We are talking to Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun, who's holding a major conference next weekend in Washington, D.C., and Ziad Asali, president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Ziad Asali, your response to the role of Elliot Abrams.
Well, obviously, on the face of it, the choice of Mr. Abrams was not very reassuring to the people who were pushing for a more energetic involvement in the peace process without appearing to be partisan. Mr. Abrams has had particularly strong relations with the right-wing part of the Jewish establishment in this country and has shown less sympathy than others to understanding the predicaments of the Palestinians and a real desire for a peaceful solution. However, Mr. Abrams clearly works for superiors. He does not set policy. It should be very clear that this is Mr. Bush's final decision, and it is his vision, and it is his political calculus that will determine the degree of seriousness of application and commitment to this roadmap. It is possible that Mr. Abrams would be in a position to advance certain minor implementation problems, but it is very unlikely that he would be determinant in setting policy. All in all, he has a record and the legitimacy with Sharon and with the right-wing government of Israel to actually help apply the needed pressure for the concessions, not cosmetic concessions, fundamental concessions that will lead us to a two-state solution on the international border.
It's interesting. The Washington Post article says that at the time of Abrams' appointment, Middle East policymaking in the White House was in a state of turmoil. Responsibility for shaping policy toward a vast troubled area of the world was divided among three officials, each with the title of senior director. The original National Security Council Department chief, Zalmay Khalilzad, focused mainly on dealings with the Iraqi opposition and had the reputation of being a poor administrator. A third official, Flint Leverett, had responsibility for the Middle East peace process. Administration insiders said Abrams' clash with Leverett and Assistant Secretary of State William J. Burns, the State Department's top Middle East expert, over the shape of the final Israeli-Palestinian peace settlement. Burns and Leverett believed any agreement probably would resemble a deal offered to the Palestinians by Barak in early 2001, with the Israelis giving up nearly all the occupied territories in return for Palestinians surrendering their right to return to Israel. Abrams envisaged more limited Israeli concessions. Rabbi Lerner.
Yes, that's why I think that what we're seeing today is a carefully orchestrated charade in which Abrams and the people whom he represents in the administration have convinced Bush that if we can go on this roadmap through the election, he will not have he will be able to, on the one hand, portray himself as being pro-peace and pro-reconciliation, and hence come through with his promise to have done something after the Iraq war that looks like a positive benefit for the people of the region. But on the other hand, that the process will end after the election with nothing, that is, with an offer for a Palestinian state that is unacceptable to the Palestinian people. And Elliot Abrams represents the most compromised and morally compromised section of the Jewish people of the United States. He comes from the commentary crowd. As you know, Tikkun was formed as the progressive and liberal alternative to commentary in the Jewish world. We see Abrams and the other court Jews who believe that the best interests of the Jewish people will be served if they make an alliance with and serve the interests of the most powerful ruling elites in the United States, as actually playing a very destructive role, a very hurtful role for the Jewish people, because Jews get identified with some of the most repressive policies of the United States in the world, including the war in Iraq. So now he has engineered a plan here, which is very clever, but it's fundamentally a charade, and it will never end in the ending of the occupation and the creation of a serious Palestinian state. They're absolutely determined against it. They're committed against it. They believe it is a betrayal of their own vision of what's best in the interests of Israel and best interests of the United States. So don't expect that this guy and the Bush administration are going to yield a real peace settlement that will give the Palestinian people the self-determination that they deserve. And without that, Israel will never have security. That's our fundamental point, that those who are really pro-Israel would understand that the fate of Israel is fundamentally, intrinsically linked to the fate of the Palestinian people, and that the best way to achieve security for the Palestinian, for Israel, is to achieve dignity and self-determination for the Palestinian people. And conversely, the best way for Palestinians to achieve self-determination is to grant real security for Israel, that the two are fundamentally linked. But Elliot Abrams doesn't believe that. Elliot Abrams believes that the domination of the West Bank can continue forever, just as Ariel Sharon does.
Why do you think the APAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, has gotten so powerful in this country in terms of legislation and political clout?
Well, number one, it has very successfully organized a section of the Jewish world that cares about Israel, and it has positioned itself as the articulator and supporter of the policies of Israel without regard to what the government is. So it claims not to be representing a particular faction in Israel, but in actuality, it has supported the most right-wing policies in Israel. Now, what it has done simultaneously is to turn to the American public and say to any Jews who are critical of Israel, of Israeli policy, you are a self-hating Jew. And to Americans who dare to critique Israeli policy, it is said, you're an anti-Semite. And the truth is that given the decency of many Americans and the recognition that there has in fact been a long history of Christian oppression of Jews and a certain guilt about that long history of oppression, a guilt which I think is appropriate, what has happened is that has allowed AIPAC to manipulate that guilt in a way that really isn't in the interest of the Jewish people, namely by saying to Americans, you will be, you're really continuing your long legacy of hatred of Jews unless you go along with whatever Ariel Sharon wants and whatever the right wing in Israel wants. And then they have very cleverly made an alliance with the most reactionary elements in the Christian world, evangelical Christians who fantasize that once Israel is strong, the prophecies of the Bible will be realized, the prophecies of the New Testament, in which Jews will eventually be all converted to Christianity with and the second coming of Jesus will happen. Well, the Jews who are making the alliance with them say, we're not so sure that Jesus will come, but in the meantime, we can use them for political support. So AIPAC has been very, very clever in that way. But on the other hand, those of us who are critical of Israeli policy have not yet organized in a serious way, and that's what we're doing in this Washington gathering. The Tikkun community, and by the way, you can find us on the web at www.tikkun.org. TIKKUN.org. The Tikkun community is organizing on the grassroots level and all over the country. We're going to bring people to Washington this year, and we hope to do it year after year after year. Bring people to Washington to present an alternative worldview. But until the progressive world does that, until the progressive world seriously organizes at the grassroots level, from congressional district to congressional district, AIPAC is going to have tremendous shaping power. It does have that power right now in Washington. It terrifies the people in the administration who would like to try to push for a reconciliation between Israel and Israel and Palestine. It terrifies them. It makes it marginalizes people like Powell, who would like to take a more significant step towards harmony between Israel and Palestine, and it elevates people like Elliot Abrams there, who actually want to make sure that the occupation continues, even though under another name.
Ziad Asli of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, part of the cabinet endorsement that Sharon got was after President Bush rejected his demand that the text incorporate 14 changes proposed by Israel. But in accepting the plan on Sunday, the Wall Street Journal reports, Israeli ministers insisted all the suggested changes be implemented in full as the roadmap is put into effect. They also issued a separate statement rejecting any Palestinian right of return to Israel for refugees displaced by the 1948 Arab-Israeli war. Can you respond to that?
Yes, let me just state what I consider to be the Palestinian position that is very clear. There will be peace for all concerned and security for all concerned only if a genuine two-state solution with the trappings and the fundamentals of independence for a viable Palestinian state is established on the 1967 line. How we get there is a question of time. How many people will get killed, how many homes demolished, it doesn't matter. But eventually, this is the only solution that is going to offer peace. Any ploys, undermining, deceit, political shenanigans used by any administration is going to be just a delay in getting there. So now we do have a potential for a solution, regardless of the incredible suspicion that all parties have of each other, including of the United States and its intentions. It is still something that can be made to work if people are interested in peace. Now, what we have is a map that has something for everyone. If we line up forces, enough political pressure everywhere, especially in this country, to push for a genuine solution, not a sham solution, nothing that's related to elections or to the power of this lobby or that lobby, a genuine solution to put an end and to put this problem to bed once and for all, then we do, all of us, Christians, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Palestinians, whatever, all of us, progressives, academicians, to apply pressure for a genuine application of an independent, viable Palestinian state on the 67 border modified. Now, of course, the present Israeli government is going to say, no, we're going to continue the settlements and we're going to never give up on this and that. That is, by definition, while they're in there. This is their political ideology. The question is, do they have absolute power? The answer is definitely no. the Jewish community in this country, like the Arab community and all other communities, is not a monolith. It is a divided and contentious problem that we're dealing with, and we I think expect rightly that the majority of Jewish people, as the majority of the Palestinian people, are for these obvious solutions, the two-state solutions. They have not translated the majorities in both communities and in the United States to generate political programs that are effective and are able to transform that majority into a decisive decision-making. This is our task. This is how we view our task in this roadmap.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Ziad Asli, President of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun, website of ADC, Ziad Asli.
Thank you. ADC.org. ADC@ADC.org.
And information on the conference next weekend, Rabbi Lerner.
www.tikkun.org. And by the way, Ziad Asli will be speaking at that conference.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Greg Palast has gotten a hold of top-secret USAID documents on Iraq. We're also going to talk about the Congo and the role of Western corporations like Barrick Gold in a war that has taken millions of lives. Stay with us.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace and equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice.
Peter Tosh, Equal Rights, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. BBC investigative reporter Greg Palast has gotten his hands on some explosive documents from USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, on Iraq. Can you talk about it, Greg Palast?
Yes, it's quite something. It's 101 pages, which you're not supposed to see, of course. And I do want to credit the Wall Street Journal for first finding it. I also obtained a copy. And but they had one article and it disappeared. It's worth reading into particulars. What this is a master plan for reorganizing the entire economy of Iraq. And only in one page of the 101 pages does it mention that there will be a possible request for input from the Iraqis. This is very, very specific, 101 pages. Everything from eliminating virtually all of the nation's trade protections. The United States will fill out the application of Iraq for the World Trade Organization, including a promise to turn it into a free trade zone. It's organizing the pipelines, rewriting the tax structure in detail, and here's the key one, mass privatization of every industry in Iraq, including the sell-off of the oil fields. And if that happens, I think the Mideast is going to explode.
Greg Palast, what about major Bush donors' involvement in this?
Well, I mean, you can almost, just like the energy law, if you remember, was done by a committee of corporate bigs sitting in a room, including Ken Lay of Enron and oil company executives sitting in a room with Dick Cheney literally rewriting our energy laws. This has the big giant thumbprints of some of the biggest corporate donors. And in fact, through separate reports, I've been able to learn that on rewriting the trade laws of Iraq, we've got Hillary Rosen, who is the chief lobbyist for the recording industry of America, rewriting what's called the intellectual property laws, in other words, copyright laws. To make it simple, for whatever reason, we've sent our tanks into the streets of Baghdad, and it seems to be for the purpose of making sure that no Iraqi has an illegal dub of a Madonna song. We also have Grover Norquist apparently working on this. He is a lobbyist for American Express and Microsoft, rewriting the tax laws of Iraq so that it will be what it details in here, that the tax laws of Iraq will be changed into a very regressive system of sales taxes and what are called value-added taxes. That changes, in other words, that's kind of a regressive tax that they use in Europe, which is like an internal hidden sales tax. Now, that's to replace the fact that almost all of Iraq's government functions have been funded by oil revenues. But if you sell off the oil fields, there won't be any more oil revenues. So they have to. So it's a two-punch plan. First, you grab the fields, and then because you will now have bankrupted the Iraqi treasury, you will now impose a whole set of new regressive taxes.
And preparation for Iraq's entry into the World Trade Organization?
I mean, that's really one of the stunning things. I mean, it's very, very detailed. And again, there's nothing about Iraqi input except for one page where I found that there may be some... here it is, page 48. They'll form a competitiveness council made of private sector leaders, in other words, big business, and in parentheses, with some government representation. But that's it. It's very, very particular, even stating where and how pipelines will be built.
Iraqi input?
Yeah, there's almost no Iraqi input in this, except for Iraqi, what they call Iraqi business leaders. It looks like Mr. Chalabi will be doing very well.
Well, Greg, I wanted to switch to another subject that you have written extensively about, and it involves the Congo. A front page article in today's New York Times begins, "They call the machete a weapon of mass destruction here. Its ghastly wreckage can be found inside what passes for this town's only functioning hospital. On a thin foam mattress lies a wide-eyed old man who survived an attempted decapitation. Nearby, a mother with black moons around her eyes nurses two wounded children back to health and mourns for another two freshly killed." The article is about the town of Bunia in the Ituri province of Congo. In the last couple of weeks, some 350 bodies have been found in the area, most of them civilian women and children. Many of the bodies are mutilated. The New York Times reports, townspeople became so terrified they tried to climb over barbed wire fences to get into the UN compound there. A tent city has sprung up in the compound, and now as many as 17,000 people have taken refuge there and at the airport and at the heart of town. The Times also reports, by the standards and logic of war in Congo, the Bunia massacre was neither unexpected nor extraordinary. The only thing that distinguished this one was that it happened before the eyes of United Nations peacekeepers who had warned of its risks. The Times goes on to say the grim facts that led to the carnage here were no mystery to anyone, certainly not to the members of the Security Council who sent in the peacekeepers. Troops from Uganda were pulling out of Ituri under a multinational peace deal. Rival warlords were at one another's throats. Indeed, there was no peace to keep in Congo's northeast, certainly not by a paltry force of some 300 blue-helmeted Uruguayan soldiers who are deployed with orders to guard United Nations property and to escort aid workers. The Times goes on, that was from the Times. The Congo's received little attention, despite the fact that it's in the throes of one of the most devastating and brutal conflicts of all time. In the last 5 years, it's estimated more than 3 million people have died in the Congo War. The conflict has been called Africa's First World War, because it's involved the national armies of seven African countries. They're all interested in the gold, diamonds, oil, timber, and other vast natural resources of the Congo. The name World War is apt because it not only involves African nations, No, it involves much more. We're joined on the phone, in addition to Greg Palast, by Joan Kuyak, who is National Coordinator of Mining Watch Canada, which has called for an independent investigation into a massacre that took place in the Congo. Let's start with Joan Kuyak on Congo and your understanding of the corporations who are interested in the natural resources of Congo.
Well, I have to correct you about something first. We called for an independent international investigation of the forced removals of a number of small-scale miners in Tanzania in 1996. We are part of a coalition in Canada that has been trying to get the Canadian government to push for United Nations intervention in a massive scale in the Congo. And we've been looking at the role of some Canadian companies in profiting from the conflicts there. There's no doubt that there's Canadian companies involved, the UN panel of experts named eight of them. The companies themselves dispute it, and there is a further investigation ongoing. One of those companies that was there at least until 1998 was Barrick Gold. First Quantum Minerals is another one, Banro, there's Tenke, there's a number of them that have been named. And they have been paying huge amounts of money to maintain and keep concessions and have certainly contributed to the conflict that's been building in the Congo. You're quite right. There's a huge demand for the very great natural resource wealth of the Congo, and it's become a completely lawless situation.
Greg Palast, you've written about Barrick Gold in your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, an investigative reporter exposes the truth about globalization, corporate cons, and high finance fraudsters. Can you talk about Barrick Gold? Though it's a Canadian company, it has links to some of the highest levels of U.S. government.
Links is one way to put it. Almost all the money of Barrick Gold Mining is actually being sucked out of a third world nation called Nevada, USA.
That's right.
They own the biggest gold mine in America, maybe the biggest in the planet, $10 billion worth of gold ore, for which they paid the United States Treasury $10,000, a deal arranged Poppy Bush was president. And by the way, who was immediately or quickly hired by Barrick Gold Mining? Poppy Bush is on their board. Now, when you get to the Congo, you read that New York Times story, and you can almost hear the jungle drums. It's only at the very back that they mention oil, diamonds, and gold. It's that, you know, those crazy Africans and the warlords, and you just feel like, well, that's how those people are. In fact, a courageous congresswoman that we had named Cynthia McKinney held special hearings after my investigations and the investigations of a great reporter named Wayne Madsen, looking into Barrick Gold Mining to determine, it looked as if their diamonds their diamond mines in the north of the Congo were fueling both sides of the civil war. It looks as if Barrick's mines were used to fuel both sides because they had a deal with Mobutu, the dictator, for a diamond mining concession. And they were, it looked like if the rebels won, of course, and for a while they, there's controlling factions that move back and forth over the land. They want to make sure that all sides are happy so they don't lose their diamond mining concessions. They're now out of there. But, and I would add something to what Joan Kuyak said. I have investigated the killings at the Tanzanian mine of Barrick Gold Mining. They are still in Tanzania. And not all the miners, Joan mentioned that some of the miners were forcibly removed, that's one way of putting it. 50 miners were buried alive. I want to repeat that. 50 miners were buried alive by the company bought by George Bush's company. So George Bush, now who else is on that board? If you're wondering why there hasn't been much complaint coming from the Democratic side of the aisle, is besides George Bush having been on the payroll, currently you have on the payroll of that same gold mining company that buried these Africans alive, you have Andy Young and Vernon Jordan. And it's one of the highest compensated boards on the planet.
And this corporation is?
And this corporation is Barrick Gold Mining.
I want to say we called Barrick Gold to join us on the show. They would not join us, and they did not want to speak with you. In fact, they deny allegations that you have put out, especially around the Tanzanian mine, and have threatened to sue every newspaper, magazine, and publisher who's attempted to touch that story.
They not only threatened, Amy, they sued. Now, my reports, investigations of the killings by in Tanzania and the Congo mine operation were published in the major paper of Europe, which is The Guardian, which is for what I write for, and The Observer newspaper. I have George Orwell's old job as investigator columnist. And they sued The Observer, and we beat Barrick to death on that one. They don't like the fact that we talk about how they picked up, how they've ripped off the U.S. taxpayer for billions. They don't like, of course, that we talk about their possible involvement in fueling the civil war in the Congo, and they don't like us talking about miners who.
They say they don't have mines in the Congo.
Oh, they do have. They did have a mine in the Congo, the diamond mines. And now, also, Daddy Bush didn't just play with Barrick Gold Mining in the Congo. The reason why Cynthia McKinney investigated is that there are several players in the Congo. We do know. My information, and it's not been denied, is that George Bush Sr., after he left the White House, not only went on the Barrick Gold Mining payroll, but he spoke to the dictator Mobutu to secure and maintain a gold mining concession for an operation called Lundin Mining in the Congo. So you have this. So you have our president. He's a golfing buddy, by the way, our president of the now the late dictator Mobutu. So they and this. Goes back to Bush's old CIA days. So one thing you should realize that the Bush family, in fact, I'm calling you from Houston right now. I'm doing further investigation into the Bush family at this moment. In fact, the information about Iraq and some of this other information will be in a special I'm here for BBC television doing a special investigative report, which will air on June 19th in Britain. You won't get to see it in the U.S., but maybe we'll talk about it as we develop more info. But I think that the story of Barrick Gold Mining, that not only have the miners been buried alive in Tanzania, not only have people been killed in the Congo to support the profits of this company, but the truth has been buried, and that's been of great concern.
The Bush, President Bush Sr., yes. Being on the board of Barrick Gold, he is no longer,
anymore.
Is that right?
Not anymore. He left in 1999 when his son was declared for president. He jumped off the board. By the way, very interesting, Barrick Gold Mining was founded and funded by that we talk about it as a Canadian company, is founded and funded by that well-known Canadian, Adnan Khashoggi. The bag man in the
Iran-Contra
arms scandal. So our president went to work for a company that was founded by Khashoggi.
The Saudi arms dealer who arranged the Iran-Contra.
It's a very interesting situation. Also, so we have our president lending his name to this operation. Now, and there's one other player in here, which goes back to your prior interview with Michael Lerner. And that's a guy named Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson has owned diamond mines, diamond mining concessions granted to him by Mobutu. Again, diamonds, gold, and
does
gold
he still own them?
Have been fueling the civil war in the Congo, partly because these are highly valuable items, which are very small.
Does he still own the diamond mines?
And, Pat seems to have lost the diamond mines in the mayhem of the Civil War. That's one of the problems. It's a very dangerous business because once you start, it's called blood diamonds. Once you start dealing in diamonds in war-torn countries, you're fueling the wars. And then, of course, once you fuel the war, you take the chance that it will overwhelm your concession.
Well, Greg Palast, I want to thank you for being with us, joining us from Houston, and Joan Kuyak, National Coordinator of the Mining Watch Canada. That does it for the show. If you want to get a copy, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for being with us.
there's too many of you to cry.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As outrage mounts over the killing of two black New Yorkers, Alberta Spruill and Usman Zango, we'll talk to the mother of another man. Her name is Katiadu Diallo. She is the mother of Amadou Diallo, who died in a hail of police bullets in 1999. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon has announced plans to send in 20,000 more U.S. troops into Iraq. The London Independent reports this will bring the total of U.S. forces to 163,000. Earlier today, two U.S. soldiers were killed, nine others wounded in Fallujah, where they were attacked by rocket-propelled grenades. This comes a day after what the Los Angeles Times called one of the most violent days against the U.S. presence since the end of the invasion. On Monday, attackers fired rocket-propelled grenades, heavy machine guns, small arms at a U.S. convoy, killing one soldier and injuring another in an attack northwest of Baghdad in the town of Haditha. Hours later, a U.S. military vehicle ran over a landmine on the outskirts of Baghdad. One soldier died and three more were wounded in the incident, which CENTCOM said appeared to be the result of hostile action. Near the site of the attack, one man told the Los Angeles Times, "This is only the beginning. These people declared holy war against the American people." A U.S. military outpost in a town north of Baghdad was also hit in a grenade attack. No injuries were reported. And in the town of Baiji near Tikrit, a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division. The device failed to explode. The Washington Post reports an average of one U.S. soldier has died every day since President Bush declared on May 1st that major combat operations in Iraq have ended. The average daily toll was three during the major combat operation. The Washington Post yesterday detailed the story of Marlon Rockhold. The 23-year-old from Hamilton, Ohio, was shot dead by a sniper in Baghdad on May 8th. On that same day, his grandmother received a letter from him dated 2 weeks earlier. It read in part, "I'm doing just fine now that the war is over here in Iraq. To actually take a man's life is more than I ever cared to do, but it was either them or me. I don't know what they were told, but God told me I was coming home." The UN's most senior humanitarian official in Iraq, Ramiro Lopez de Silva, warned yesterday that U.S. attempts to rebuild Iraq are overly dominated by ideology and risk triggering a violent backlash. According to the Guardian of London, de Silva said the sudden decision last week to demobilize 400,000 Iraqi soldiers without any reemployment program could generate a low-intensity conflict in the countryside. Meanwhile, Agence France-Presse reports a band of Iraqi army officers took to the streets of Baghdad to protest their plight since the dissolution of the army by the U.S.-led administration in Iraq. They warned of further protests and even suicide bombings if the situation is not reconciled. Under pressure from the United States, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon yesterday admitted that the Palestinian people are being held under occupation and that the occupation must end. In a speech before an assembly of Likud lawmakers, Sharon said, "It is not possible to continue holding 3.5 million people under occupation. You may not like the word, but that's what's happening, is occupation. This is a terrible thing for Israel, for the Palestinians, and for the Israeli economy." Sharon's comments came one day after his cabinet backed steps in Washington's roadmap to peace. In response to the vote, a leader in the Israeli settlers movement described it as a, quote, act of national treason. There are now 226,000 Jewish settlers living in the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, The Guardian reports Likud lawmakers berated Sharon for abandoning party ideals. Already, Sharon seems to be backtracking on key measures in the peace plan, including the halt of new Israeli settlements and the abandonment of some of the occupied territories. A settler and Likud lawmaker asked Sharon yesterday, quote, I want to know whether I can stay in my home. Sharon replied, it will definitely be possible and there is no restriction here. You can build for your children and grandchildren, and I hope even for your great-grandchildren. Meanwhile, the expected meeting tomorrow between Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his Palestinian counterpart Mahmoud Abbas has been postponed for a day. Palestinian sources told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz the delay was caused by scheduling conflicts. But The Guardian of London reports the cancellation is being interpreted as evidence that the Palestinian leader doesn't see any value in meeting Sharon, and that the Palestinians believe all of Sharon's latest moves are purely for propaganda purposes. UNICEF is warning of a looming humanitarian disaster in Aceh, where the Indonesian military has launched the largest invasion in a quarter of a century. The London Independent reports the Indonesian government has been slow to address humanitarian needs. Local officials say a massive relief operation is required, but Indonesia has told foreign aid workers to leave Aceh for security reasons. The Iranian opposition group, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, said yesterday it has evidence of two previously undisclosed uranium enrichment facilities west of Tehran. This comes as the Bush administration officials are trying to build international support for the International Atomic Energy Agency to look further into Iran's nuclear program. The Australian Mail on Sunday reports the U.S. has floated plans to turn Guantanamo Bay into a death camp with its own death row and execution chamber. Prisoners would be tried, convicted, and executed without leaving its boundaries, without a jury, and without a right of appeal. Saying black people are in danger of being left behind at the newest frontier of medical research, Howard University plans to create the nation's largest repository of DNA from African Americans, this according to the New York Times. The samples would be used to find genes involved in diseases with particularly high rates among blacks, like hypertension and diabetes. Howard plans to gather blood samples or cheek swabs from 25,000 people over 5 years, mainly patients at hospitals associated with the Howard College of Medicine. And protests against U.S. militarism continued on this past Memorial Day weekend on Sunday. Four Catholic workers were arrested aboard the USS Philippine Sea during the 16th annual Fleet Week in New York City. The four peace activists poured their blood and hammered on the missile hatches that hold Tomahawk cruise missiles. They then held up pictures of Iraqi children who'd been injured and maimed by U.S. weapons. The USS Philippine Sea fired on Iraq during the first Persian Gulf War and was the first U.S. warship to attack Afghanistan after September 11th.
Thank you.
Lloyd Campbell, Pyramid Trio. The name of that song, Amadou Diallo. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Outrage is mounting here in New York following the death of Usman Zango, gunned down by police last Thursday in a scenario strikingly similar to that of Amadou Diallo. Usman Zango was 43 years old. He fixed African artifacts for a living in the Chelsea section of Manhattan. The New York Times reports that by dozens of accounts, Zango was a quiet, gentle man who worked tirelessly to send money home to his family in Burkina Faso. Usman Zango worked in the same building where another company distributed illegal compact discs. Police raided the building last week. Zango was working nearby when he encountered 25-year-old police officer Brian Conroy. Police said Usman Zango approached Conroy, who was wearing plain clothes. For some reason, a chase ensued that ended when Usman Zango ran into a dead end. Conroy then shot him 5 times. Zango suffered wounds to the abdomen, chest, and upper back, and was grazed on the right arm. Conroy told other officers at the scene that Usman Zango reached for his gun, but there were no witnesses to confirm this. The New York Times reports that Usman Zango's friends and fellow vendors said it seemed impossible that he could run afoul of the law. Kojo Volta, a friend of Usman, said, quote, he wouldn't challenge anyone, and added he did not even have the nerve to hound customers who owed him money. The shooting came less than a week after New York police raided the Harlem apartment of Alberta Spruill. Police burst into her apartment at 6 a.m, threw in a flash grenade, and handcuffed her. She was 57 years old, a city employee for decades. Then they realized that the tip they'd received from a drug dealer was false. Alberta Spruill died from a heart attack a few hours later. Alberta Spruill was buried on Saturday after a funeral that attracted over 3,000 mourners. Michael Bloomberg, New York mayor, addressed the funeral, saying, as mayor, I failed to protect someone I was chosen to work with. We all failed humanity. An innocent human being was taken from us, and our actions caused it. Some praised Bloomberg for publicly apologizing. Some were skeptical. Civil rights attorney Norman Siegel said words are easy. Action and changes are the real test. And now looking at today's Newsday, it says that the family of the West African merchant who was fatally shot by police at the Chelsea storage facility is preparing for burial in his native village, while his uncle in New York joined the Reverend Al Sharpton and calling for a special prosecutor to investigate the death. Sharpton also called for a special prosecutor to investigate the death of Alberta Spruill, who died of a heart attack on May 16th after police detonated a flash grenade in her apartment. Sharpton said he's also looking into bringing members of Zango's family to the United States, tapping on experience in the Amadou Diallo shooting to navigate through the bureaucratic mazes. Reverend Sharpton said, I thought we learned a lot from Diallo and that we'd never have the same kind of problem again, particularly having to bring someone home to Africa that believed if they came here, they could have a better life. Amadou Diallo died in a hail of 41 police bullets on February 4th, 1999. Well, today we're going to spend the hour with Amadou's mother, Katiadou Diallo, as well as Craig Wolfe. Together, they wrote the book, My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son, Amadou. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by looking at a passage in your book that I thought is extremely instructive as we face this new scenario that took place, this new killing, where you write, quoting the papers, talking about how they referred to your son, What would the newspapers have written if Amadou had been wearing a hooded sweatshirt, bounding from a car after midnight? Suspicious African man in hooded sweatshirt startles police by jumping out of car? None of this hurt me as much as unarmed West African street vendor. This label stole his story. To call him West African revealed nothing. He'd lived in three different West African countries and five different towns or cities in Africa with subtleties that made each one distinct. He lived in two different cities in Asia, had studied in the best schools in these places, and had been part of a neighborhood in New York for nearly 2.5 years, selling, buying, eating, rooting for teams, kicking a ball in the playgrounds, going to the movies. Didn't that give him even the slightest claim to being not just a West African, but a New Yorker, too? Kadiadu Diallo, tell us about Amadou. Tell us who your son was, where he was born.
Amadou was born in September 2nd, 1975, in Liberia, where I then lived with his father. I had him when I was just 16 years old. And as I used to tell the people that we grew up together, being a teenage mother and taking care of my son, he was a sweet, loving soul. He was quiet. Some would say he's shy. And he loved education was the paramount of his life, as he inherited from his grandfather, my father, Amadou First, in our village. He was the first to be sent to school. Amadou is from a very, very decent family, good background. As you all know, a son, a child, is a gem in a mother's eye. But I'm not talking only about because he's my son. He was a very, very loving, caring, special human being. Before he came to America, this is why we began the book, by telling about my background, our village, to the town and to different cities, because it's important for the people to know him, of how he lived his life, as you said, as you describe him. It's very important. For me, his life began when his grandparents began to, you know, establish from the village. My father went to school, take care of the family, his parents. And we are from a background of my great-great-grandfather was a king from the village. So Amadou was well off from his family. And coming here in America, he carried so many things with him, which make him so special. He spoke 5 languages. He spoke French, English, little bit of Spanish, Thai, and our native tongue, Fulani. He always smiled and wanted to reach out and help people all the time. He was my eldest son.
So you moved with him from Liberia?
Yes.
To?
We moved from him when he was born in Liberia. After he was about 4 years old, we moved from Liberia to Togo, where he continued to go to school. Actually, he went to kindergarten school in Liberia, where he began in English because that's the system in Liberia. And then we moved because of the work his father was doing. We moved from Liberia to Togo. And then from Togo, he went to school in Togo before we went to Asia with all his siblings. It's interesting when we talk about the different places he have been, because every country you've been to, it will enrich you with tradition and culture that you will learn there. So he was like an international child. He knows many, many countries, Liberia, Togo, Guinea, where we're from, and then Ghana, and Bangkok, Singapore, and Malaysia. Prior to coming here, I don't think you can find a young man of his age in America to have so much of experiences than Amadou had before coming here.
We're going to break and then come back with Amadou's story, as well as your own, Kadiatu Diallo. and Craig Wolf, who was co-author of this book, My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son, Amadou. Back in a minute. Amadou Diallo by Roy Campbell and Pyramid Trio here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Kadiatou Diallo, also Craig Wolf, authors of My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son, Amadou. On Saturday, or Sunday, this weekend, hundreds of people gathered in Harlem to protest the killing of African immigrant Usman Zango, who died at the hands of a police officer last Thursday in New York City. He was planning to go back home to Burkina Faso in a few months to be with his family and to bring his artifacts home from New York. You addressed them. What did you say?
Immediately when I learned about what happened, I was completely shocked and reminded of what happened to Amadou. And I realized that as a grieving mom having to deal with this experience, I really share the grief and the sorrow of this family. You know, I talk about the sete in my book. When someone leave to go abroad from Africa, in my culture and my native tongue, we call them the sete, which means you are going away to look for better life, to find wealth and help your family, help lift your family. And if all the family expecting you to come back with wealth, success, and happiness. And now, Mr. Usman Zango, like my son, is going to go back a cold body. That is the most painful experience any family can go through. I talked to his brother. I went to Harlem on Saturday. I talked to his brother. I said, I really do not know what you're going through in whole, because grieving is private, is separate, but I know what I have been through and I share the pain with you. And he told me that he had a wife and two kids. And this family, what can we tell them? His wife, his children, who are expecting their father, the husband, to come home. You know, what struck me always when something like this happened is that the blame always go to the victim. Always there's something wrong with the victim. Either they are trying to grab the arm from the officer, or they have done some gesture that was wrong. Always they try to find argument to place on the victim. And most importantly, what I really voice vividly in the book, me and my co-author, was to the stereotyping of the victim. You know, this my son become the unarmed West African seed vendor that was killed, and I did not recognize him on that tag. So it's important for him to have his family come forward and represent him on this most difficult time of their life. It's not going to get easy as time goes by, and the experience that they will have to face is to come from different country, flying in and meeting a new country in this circumstance. It's very hard. I cannot think of any remedy. Osman Zongo, if he violate any law, supposed to be arrested and be charged on something, but not being shot at and killed. As for my son Amadou, there was not a fight. There was not a chase. He was in his own vestibule that night. So we are all sharing the same pain. And I just wish that this never happened, that my son's death would have helped the police to do their job better and saving lives. But unfortunately, it happened again.
Kadiatou Diallo, why did Amadou come to the United States?
Amadou came to the United States to realize his dream, and he wanted to succeed on his own. You know, as people immigrate in this country, millions and millions of people, at the end, you have the same goal, but there are different reasons. Amadou came because he dreamt about America early on, and he grew up actually loving America, talking about the sports, basketball, and the music, and the education that he wanted to achieve. This is what brought him here. And he came as a young man, but it was like an old soul in a young man's body. He wanted to be independent. Because I'm a very protective mother. I used to really cuddle my children and think about them as children, not seeing them as growing up people. So the first time Amadou came, I called him at the first phone call. I asked him to actually get warm clothes and socks and stuff to protect him, because it was winter in September 26, 1996. He said to me, "Please, this time, let me handle this. I know what to do." So you can imagine, he was happy being in the Bronx, new community, but distant relative living with him in the same building. And they recreate some type of community here, sharing food, sharing stories for their homeland. And also, he was looking forward to be enrolled in college. But because of his position, he had to make money. And I believe so many people here began to do this way before they can see success. Amadou began to, first job he got was to be a delivery man from an electronic company. And he did that job for 2 years, actually. About 5 months before his death, he changed job to become a street vendor. And he was selling his things in Manhattan. This is where we talk in the book about the city coming to him. He was happy being in Manhattan and seeing people. And so many people I met during my stay here tell me that my son used to smile at them every time they passed by. And he was saving his money When I got here, I get into his building, his apartment. We found an envelope of some money he had saved and some money he had kept from one of our distant relatives. In Hall, he had saved about $9,000, and he was about to enroll in college. The reason was to be successful that brought him here. And he chose America because he loved America. He wanted to be here. And for the first time in his life, he was about to succeed. The last time we spoke on telephone was on January 31st, 1999. He said to me, "Mom, I will do it. I'll do it. I am so happy now. I just need your blessings and your prayers."
And then you got that phone call, and you write very movingly about everything that followed, which was certainly just a tumult of emotion, horror, and action, because you got the call. Where were you?
I was then in Guinea, my country, in Conakry, the capital. You know, I believe there is a connection between a mother and a child. When something happened, you have this feeling. When the call came early in the morning in my former house, because I moved to a new house and my sister got the call, my younger sister, she calls me and she said, "Someone is trying to talk to the man in the house." But I told him that I was alone, so can you tell me? He hung up. Then she told me that. I said, "Oh my God." I said, "I have the feeling that if someone call at this time, knowing the difference of time between America and my country, it was really early in the morning because it was about 7 a.m. in Guinea. So it must have been about 4 a.m. here." And I said, "If someone call at this time, if it is not my son Amadou, I really feel that it will be about him." I was having all this fear and also rejecting the thought that I have to say, "No, don't think like that. It will become reality." And the other sense will tell me, "No, it is about him. Maybe something wrong." So I struggle with this idea and praying and crying until finally I got the last call from a man, always looking for the man of the house. He said to me, "Is your husband in?" This is my second husband, because I had divorced with the father and I'm remarried to a new husband. So I said, "No, my husband is not in. What is going on?" He said, "No, I just want to talk to somebody, a man in the house." Then immediately my daughter came, because she was hearing my voice coming and yelling, crying, and then she grabbed me and helped me to sit on the couch. This is when I talk in the story that, "Please God, don't make me a child again," because I was like becoming the child and my daughter was becoming like the mother and helping me to get me together. It was a day I will never be able to forget.
Who was it who called you?
It is a man I knew in Togo. And in fact, he lived with us in Togo when Amadou was a young boy. And he was concerned, really shocked, and wanted for me to get the news, but at the same time worry about me telling me directly. And I held all my strength and told him. I asked him, I said, "Tell me, I believe in God and I'm Muslim, I have faith. It's my son. Had Amadou died?" So he kept silent for a moment and then he said, "Yes." That's when we know. That's when we know that at that moment, I really wanted to become anything I could become. I could become to cross the ocean to get here. I wanted to reverse the clock, not to let that time come, you know, be happening, to go back to the past, to tell my son how I loved him. And, you know, you never say enough. You never. It's just sad.
You made it to the United States a few days later, 5 days later. Can you talk about what happened here and how you made your way to 1157 Wheeler Avenue?
I got the visa and tickets, and I got here on February 9 at 1:30 p.m. On the aircraft, I looked at the tarmac and I saw the police cars, you know, with these flashing lights, and I thought maybe something is happening, maybe a reception or some kind of thing interesting happening. I don't realize it was for me. After we landed, I heard a comment from the microphone that Mrs. Diallo, please identify yourself. And I came forward. I said, yes, this is me. Then there was a policeman plus another gentleman asked me, can you follow us? And I said, I'm coming. I have come with my husband and my uncle. They said, okay, come, please follow me. They took us from the aircraft below to the tarmac, and I was upset because, you know, I don't know what was happening. No one told me that it was going to be that way. So I said, as they tried to take me to the van, I said to them, no, I have to speak. I must speak to this woman. I saw the Ghanaian ambassador waiting for me also with her protocol. I said, I grabbed her, and she said to them, let me take her. I want to take her with me because the Ghanaian official called us from Conakry telling us that she's coming. And the people said, no, we cannot let that happen. We have to go with her. So she told me, don't panic. I'm going to come in right behind you, but don't say anything. But of course, I was in panic. So I demanded I have to be taken at 1157 Wheeler, where my son lived and died. I describe in the book about how I felt on the road, the things that I saw on my way, the details that I didn't know about, you know, the gravities, the train, you know, that flying over, and I was, you know, just looking at all these things, and then, you know, the community, the view was changing as we progress, you know, forward. Then upon arrival at the site, I saw the huge crowd, the media and people. I realized right then at that moment that my life as I had known it will never be the same. And I was jumping out of the van immediately, and the lady that was with me in the van called somebody on the cell phone saying that I had landed there with me. So everything was just happening quickly around me. I didn't know what was going on. And upon seeing the media, I heard a voice that struck me. There was a man walking by and saying, look at me, look at me. My name is Frankie. Why that grabbed me is because, you know, he was a young man and almost like my son. So to me, I just have to call my son's name. I just call Amadou's name. And I don't think I remember much or something, anything come into focus. I was calling his name. And somebody tell me, when we got into the vestibule, that yes, It's just so hard to go back into all this. That yes, it is the place where we find your son's body, in this tiny vestibule. I dropped down and I said, leave me here. Leave me here. I want to be here. And help me, you know, just help me again, walk me through. We entered the apartment where my son lived and I got into his bedroom. I sat on his bed. I saw his clothes. I saw his books. I saw his prayer rug, and I had his, you know, I held his prayer beads that he used to, even back in Bangkok, that's what he uses for his prayers, because he was very religious. And I saw his books, everything, and he used to read a lot. He loved to read. And I held his T-shirts that he used to wear in Bangkok. I just have the feelings that I wanted to smell it, just to feel him. And I did it. So I let it off for some time because it was a moment that, you know, you have to just let it go. I cry for my loss. People came in, you know, talking with me about the experience, because some of the people live in the same house with him. I saw Mamadou Alpha, one of his roommates, you know, his eyes were red and he cried a lot. His wife used to cook for them, actually. That night when Amadou got killed, his wife was not in New York. So it was a night that was unusual for them not to come and got a pot of rice in their apartment. Aissatou was, the wife of Mamadou Alpha, was visiting her sister in Atlanta. So I guess my son must have went out for some food. You know.
And the books he brought with him to the United States?
He brought, as he left Conakry, my brother Wuri, who sent him, you know, at the airport, told me, because when Amadou left, I was in a trip on business. Wuri told me Amadou had a book, the Quran is the first thing he always picked up when he's going away, and he had the book about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and he has a computer sciences book that he had in Singapore when he had his computer courses. This is actually the major he wanted to follow up, because the credit he earned in Singapore could be transferred in American university. Plus other books that he bought here. He had books about love. He was thinking about getting married. He had books about history. So many. In fact, if you see his, when I look at his belongings, he had more books than clothing and shoes.
We're talking to Kadiatou Diallo. She has written the book with Craig Wolfe, My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son, Amadou. When we come back, I want to ask you about the trial and how the two of you came to write this book together. Stay with us.
Okay.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find.
sides. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Marvin Gaye, What's Going On? Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Today we're joined by the mother of Amadou Diallo, Kadiatou Diallo, and Craig Wolfe, who've written the book together, My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son, Amadou. And we speak in this tragic week in New York when two people of color, two black New Yorkers, have been killed by the New York Police Department. Alberta Spruill, a many-year city worker, police stormed into her apartment with a flash grenade, handcuffed her, realized they had the wrong person. She died of a heart attack. And just a few days now, after a young man from Burkina Faso, Ousmane Zango, was cornered in the area where he worked in New York by an undercover police officer, and he was shot five times. And Kadiatou Diallo came out this weekend and spoke at a rally in Harlem where hundreds of people gathered to protest his death. Now, Reverend Al Sharpton says, as was done in the case of Amadou, he wants to bring the family of Ousmane Zango to New York. Kadiatou Diallo now lives here in Maryland with her children. She came here for the first time after her son Amadou died in a hail of police bullets, February 4th, 1999. We don't have that much more time, and I wanted to ask about the trial and about the four police officers who were acquitted in your son's death.
Yeah, before we go to the trial, I want to talk about... The first time I came to America was before Amadou came, actually. I have visited America before, and I met so many people that were here. And the trial situation, when the indictment came, I really was thinking that the trial will be happening in the Bronx, where Amadou was killed. Because this is the community that have more experiences to deal with the police than any other place, I imagine. And but unfortunately, the trial was moved to Albany, rural upstate New York, where I was told a police officer never got convicted in a police shooting case before. They said it was because of the publicity that they did that. But actually, I don't understand this. Anyway, I thought the prosecutor supposed to have their own statistic also when the defense lawyers did their own statistics saying that the police officers would not have a fair trial. They would not have a fair jury in the Bronx. The prosecutor supposed to do the contrary to prove to the judge the opposite. But during the trial, I was there not to argue the case because I'm not a lawyer, I'm a grieving mother. But I believe something was left out was about the young man that was killed. Everything happened around the technicality of the trial. Nobody speak for Amadou. I was stuck by that, and in fact, even a photo of Amadou was not shown to the jury. The education Amadou had prior to coming here, it was about, if Amadou don't speak English at all, and or he don't understand police command. To give the people the real picture of Amadou's life, I believe that they're supposed to give opportunity to the family to testify on behalf of Amadou, to know who he was. This was my major concern. I was in the courtroom observing everything unfold in front of my eyes. The most difficult thing any mother can go through. You cannot say anything. You just have to watch everything being told. I got a meeting with the prosecutor once only. I asked him, why don't you try to take the jury to the Bronx so that they can go into the vestibule and have the feeling of this place, how tiny it is. It's like a small elevator. But he says, no, don't worry, we would argue the case just here. So the Weller Avenue need to be known to everybody. It is not a wild place or dangerous place. In fact, even a baby has been born in the same house, and people continue to live in there. Children are riding bicycle around. And I believe if the jury had the opportunity to go and visit the site, maybe something would have been different.
Your reaction when the acquittal came down?
Well, I said it in my book. I wanted to stand up and say to the judge, you have not introduced your guests. I am Amadou's mother. But then I think back, tears rolling down my face, my two hands, one on every hand in my brother's hand, my two brothers was, you know, sitting with me. I cried. I thought if I did that, maybe he would see me as a wild African woman just screaming. So I did not say anything. I just sat down and watched everyone as they move out. I held my head high and I walked out. It was very, very difficult for me as a mother, seeing the trial and the verdict of your own son's killing while you know it was not his fault, and they said they were not guilty for anything. It's, for me, it is like they said Amadou was guilty and he was blamed for his death. This is my reaction.
Craig Wolf, how did you come to write this book, to meet Kadiatou Diallo and write with her, My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son, Amadou? You're an assistant professor at Columbia University School of Journalism, former reporter with the New York Times.
Well, interestingly, I had actually known Amadou's father, and he had come to speak at my class at Columbia a couple of times. And so I already was oriented and knowledgeable to a certain extent about the story. We were introduced by an intermediary. Mrs. Diallo was looking for someone to help her tell her story. And I think the reason that we were able to connect so quickly and with the common mindset of truly getting behind this label, the unarmed West African street vendor. Even hearing Mrs. Diallo talk this morning, I'm reminded that not only does that tag take away Amadou's story, but it also stifles the imagination of anyone who hears that label or reads that label. It becomes that much more difficult to see a person with all his glorious particulars, to see him as, and this is what we tried to do in the book, to see him as a small boy jumping into the bowl of yogurt in his grandmother's yard, to see a young Kadi in the village of her grandmother, watching the flame from the bricks or the stones that stayed lit all night. And dreaming about what her life would be about, to see her being given away at the age of 13, a bride, bewildered, completely bewildered, and yet owning somehow this strong sense of self. There's a real tale here. And in some ways, frankly, I see myself as someone who likes to tell stories and to help Mrs. Diallo tell her story. In some ways, this story would be a beautiful, amazing story, even if her name was not Diallo, and that it ended, and it hasn't ended yet, we should say, because it keeps going in many ways, both tragic as we see over this past weekend, but also triumphant. I mean, this is as you listen.
You know, and the reason to write the book is because I came to America when Amadou was killed. But then I reach into myself, reminiscing about our lives. Then we realize the most important thing in life is to tell the story just as, you know, the way we live our life. And Craig, I connect to him. When I talked to him the first time, he said to me, I'm not going to read any newspaper. I just want to listen to you. Then I knew I had a true partner to help me put this story together. And for the world to know how Amadou lived his life, how his ancestors lived their lives, it is a noble cause for me to do as a mother, because everyone know how he died. And I want the world to know him through life.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us and for telling your story. Kadiatou Diallo, we didn't even touch on your feminism. You're from an early age, married at 13, standing up for your rights, for the rights of your children, and your own journey. And we will save that for another hour. Okay. I want to thank you for sharing your strength, your story, and your son's story today.
Thank you so much.
Amadou Diallo, Kadiatou Diallo, and Craig Wolfe. My heart will cross this ocean. My story, my son, Amadou. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Last news items. Former New York City Police Chief Bernard Kerik is in Baghdad training on law and order. And Mayor Giuliani, the former mayor who was mayor during the time of the killing of Amadou Diallo, just got a $4.3 million contract to bring, quote, law and order to Mexico City. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman.